The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Are you a clinic owner searching for something new this year? Do you have unhappy clients with a mystery illness the doctors can't treat? Then it's time to try out our latest professional systems. My name is Kevin Davis. With our bioresonance system, we start with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments to strengthen, meridian stimulation, pathogen discovery, session guides, lifetime support, and a lot more. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today.
Welcome to the Yes to Life show, the weekly show about all things to do with integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that helps people with cancer to understand and access integrative medicine. My guest today is an all-time integrative medicine hero, someone who laid the very ground for the changes we're beginning to see today and who can truly be said to have changed the face of cancer care. Ralph Moss is a medical writer, author of many seminal books on cancer care, as well as a consultant, a blogger, a video blogger. He has advised and held posts at many of America's top cancer institutions. Ralph has just published a new online free book, The Ultimate Guide to Cancer, DIY Research, to empower people to be able to do their own research. I wanted to find out more, so I'm talking to Ralph over Skype on the east coast of the US. Right, Ralph, I'm so pleased to have you back on the Yes to Life show. Thanks very much indeed.
Pleasure to be here.
So you've written some of the most highly respected material on cancer, and particularly, of course, complementary and alternative cancer treatments. You're describing The Ultimate Guide to Cancer DIY Research as the single most important document you've published in 45 years. So why do you feel it's so important?
Well, you know, I've been in this field since the early to mid-70s, and I've written a whole host of reports on diagnosis-specific reports. I think we're up to about 40 of them. At one time, we had more than 100.
Wow.
But we've scaled it back to just cover like the 95% of the cancers that occur. But still, it's a huge swath of material, and a lot of that has been me applying my research methods, some things I learned in my PhD program, some things that I learned at Sloan Kettering, and a lot that I learned in my association with the NIH in the 1990s, but applying that to the different types of cancer. But what I never really did was tell people how to do their own research.
Right.
So they're coming to me and paying a bunch of money for me to analyze, you know, their situation, or doing a phone consultation or an email consultation. But that's all about me. It's not really about them. In other words, we try to make it about them as much as possible, but I'm the one doing the research, and then they have to pay me to do that. So when my son Ben joined me in my company, he felt that, you know, well, we have to give back as well as take from the public. And the best way we could give back would be to show them how we do that research. Mm. It isn't necessary for me to do it, and I'm not going to always be around to do it. So we want to share that knowledge, because I think, I mean, my methods are not all that different from what other people do, but very few people know how to do that. And when cancer patients go on the internet to research their own condition, I'd say that there's more than even odds that they're going to be misled in one way or another.
Yes.
If they have a research background, that doesn't necessarily equip them to enter these, these paths. It's like you're hiking and you're used to hiking on, you know, well-trod blazed paths, and now suddenly you find yourself sort of wandering off into the swamps,
right.
You know, because there's no more blazes on the trees to be had, so you've got to find your own way. So I wanted to write something that would not just tell them how they should approach their own cancer, but how you begin to utilize the resources that are out there in order to find your own way. Mm. And we wanted to make that free. And it became sort of an obsession. I mean, we started to do this, you know, it was going to be like, have this for me next week kind of thing. And the weeks wore on, and I wasn't loafing. I mean, I actually was working intensively on this for months because I really wanted to get this right. And I was very pleased, and I am very pleased with the way that it turned out, although it isn't the easiest thing that I ever wrote. But, you know, I was going back and forth with readability indexes to make sure that the language was accessible to the to anybody who made the effort. Mm. And actually, it comes in at about a 9th or 10th grade level in terms of the language, which isn't too bad. I mean, believe it or not, you know, you want to aim for like an 8th grade level, you know, junior high school or middle school level in terms of your writing, because there's a fair number of people out there who really can't or won't tackle something that's more difficult than that. But I tried to make this, in other words, as simple as I could without sacrificing the accuracy, which adds an additional burden in terms of the writing, because you know you may feel like you've got the perfect phrasing of something, and then you find out, well, but that particular phrasing is going to fly over the heads of some of the people you're trying to reach, so you have to redo that. Mm-hmm. But in the end, you know, we wound up with a 60-page document that it's pretty easy to summarize, I mean, what my findings were, because, you know, as I took the case of a fairly common situation, which is stage 3 colon cancer, and something like half the people diagnosed with colon cancer or bowel cancer aren't in stage 3, which is, say, locally advanced, you know, lymph node involvement, some invasion of the wall, but not broken through, not metastasized or spread to other organs. But just take that phase, that stage 3 situation. Or how do you deal with that? How do you analyze the information that's being thrown at you? What are the, you know, the key phrases that are being used to describe its effectiveness, and what actually should you be looking at when you're confronting your own cancer in terms of what are the treatment options and how effective are the treatments?
Mm. Well, look, I was going to say how impressed I was by the genuine readability of it. It's quite an achievement to talk about such a complex subject in good old plain English. Is not easy, is it?
It's not easy.
It is a very easy read, though. And with the acronym DIY in the title, well, it's got to be, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but as I said, I'm not suggesting that you go to Home Depot or whatever the British equivalent is of Home Depot. I imagine the British equivalent is Home Depot. But in any case, you know what I'm saying. You don't go down to the local hardware store and pick up some tools, you know, to operate on yourself. I mean, I'm just being facetious, but you can do this research at home with your computer or with books if you choose, or in the library. So it's going to be very little cost. There's some costs involved, but mostly it's going to be something so you could use this as a guide to doing your own research or your own situation.
Right.
Or somebody you.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the outset, you're kind of best known for bringing a bit of scientific rigor to the whole world of complementary and alternative medicine and cancer, but that doesn't mm-hmm. really feature in this guide, does it? That's not really what you're trying to achieve here, is to give a guide to the world, that whole world. Maybe you want to say a bit about that.
Sure. Well, this is, I run into a lot of people, talk to a lot of people who have rejected conventional medicine entirely. Mm-hmm. And often, sometimes that's because they really are past the point at which conventional medicine has anything to offer. After all, I mean, if a 500,000 people are dying of cancer, you have to know that a lot of those people went through all the stages of the conventional treatment and then eventually were given few options, maybe a clinical trial or maybe just hospice care. So there's a lot of people for whom that's a legitimate stance, that they're not going to do chemo, they're not going to do radiation, maybe not do surgery. On the other hand, I meet a fair number of people who have ruled it out on philosophical grounds or because of something, the things that they read, or because they feel, you know, they read that you could control this easily with natural methods. So this is, I think, before, my point is, and I've gotten some flack for this, but my point is that before you rule out the conventional methods, you should at least know what those conventional methods are, what benefit or harms they are likely to bring you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems so elementary, right? Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't you do that? You'd want to know what's involved and what would be the possible benefit. So there are situations where I think it's foolish to turn up your nose at treatments that have a proven track record of benefit. But people do it all the time. I meet these people all the time. And I'm a pragmatist. I do believe in natural medicine. I don't take any prescription medications myself whatsoever. I hardly take anything at all. I mean, I just rely on natural means of, of being healthy. But cancer is a little different. Cancer is a unique disease, I would say, because it can form in a seemingly healthy person. We don't understand this, but I can't tell you how many people I speak to tell me that I was completely healthy, I did all the right things, and here I am with this aggressive cancer. It doesn't seem to make any sense at all.
No.
And so I think, you know, you've got a failure, and whatever our innate methods are of controlling this life-threatening situation, they have obviously failed, but it isn't always a failure in the normal sense that I got weakest, and then I got cancer. I mean, that sometimes seems to happen, but there's also the Lance Armstrongs of the world, you know, who are in the absolute 0.01% top physical condition and wind up with testicular cancer. How do you explain that? I mean, it isn't a simple disease like, oh, I got run down and then I got the flu, but you can get cancer even if you're quote-unquote, you know, healthy and fit. So obviously cancer is a different disease than a lot of what we're used to. And a lot of people are just not familiar with this. So they think that they could just control this by natural methods and everything's going to be fine and it's going to go away. Now, that hasn't been my experience at all. I see, as I say, maybe it's a selection, but you see, if you're in this field long enough, you see a lot of people where you need intervention and vigorous intervention and rapid intervention in order to stop this from happening. So I guess this is a long way of, a roundabout way of saying that you should consider the conventional therapy, which seems funny because, you know, more often than not, one is in the opposite position of saying you should consider the complementary or the alternative treatments. But I'm not an advocate of complementary medicine. As I say, I use it myself. I try to stay as natural as possible, but I would not avoid taking a conventional medicine if the benefits of that medicine outweigh the harms associated with it. So that's my position. And as I say, I've gotten a fair amount of flack for having stated this, because there's a lot of people out there who are ardent advocates for this alternative or that alternative. But I find that very often it isn't really a rational, that's not like a rational thing. It's more an emotive thing.
Agreed.
That they want to believe this.
Agreed, this yes.
is the case.
Well, it's important, isn't it? I mean, that emotive divide is where we've come from. It's been a war, let's face it. You've been out there in the
yes.
in the trenches.
Yeah.
And that's where we come from, but it's kind of a bit old hat now. And the pragmatic view that you are putting forward is really the way forward. This is what integrative medicine means. It means you look at everything
yeah.
that might help you
right.
stay alive. And it doesn't even make sense
right.
not to, does it? But
right.
when you're driven by emotion, you can do some rather weird things. So, but
right.
yeah, cancer, it does. It's my experience as well. It seems to be a disease that it's a thing of momentum, it seems to me. When
mm-hmm.
you've got a cancer with a lot of momentum, you're probably not going to get away with natural methods. You need something to actually
right.
slow it down, to knock it on the head. But if you've got something
yes.
which has got low momentum, you can probably control it for years by natural methods. So
right.
you know, it's sort of horses for courses, it seems like.
So what interests me the most and has interested me the most for 45 years has been immunology, immunotherapy. And I had a very, very fortunate to have had this unique education of having been a young science writer hired in my 20s, turned 30, I think, 30. Well, I was about 30 when I was hired at Sloan Kettering. And just so happened that the year before, the board of trustees at Sloan Kettering had swept out all the old people in the leadership, I mean, and they had brought in a new team. And that team, three out of the four top leaders were immunologists.
Mm.
And so, you know, we think of immunology or immunotherapy as being a fairly new development dating from, let's say, 2011 or so.
Right.
But that's not the case. I mean, it's been there in the background and sometimes in the foreground since 1893. Mm. So it isn't as if this is something that, you know, just happened with Jim Allison getting the Nobel Prize last year. It's been going on all that time. And so I came in at a high point in the ups and downs of immune therapy because my bosses, and who were also to a certain degree my mentors, were fully in the thick of that. That's what they did. That's why they were hired at Sloan Kettering, was to usher in the new era of immune therapy. The problem is that they kind of got ahead of themselves and the field wasn't right yet. It wasn't right yet for actually supplanting chemo. Chemotherapy was still on the ascendancy.
It was king, yeah.
In the 90s. It was king and stayed so for another couple of decades, and it wasn't immune therapy that finally supplanted chemo, or at least intellectually speaking, it was targeted therapy.
Mm.
So the idea of targeting the cancer more specifically, in other words, not just poisoning the cancer and seeing what gets killed and hoping that more cancer cells will get killed than normal cells, that was something that was rejected by the leadership of the oncology profession in the 1990s.
Mm.
And what supplanted that was this idea of Judah Folkman, one of the real influential figures in the whole history of cancer research.
Mm.
But Folkman showed that if you could deprive a cancer of its blood supply, its ability to form new blood vessels or recruit existing blood vessels, you could restrict it to the size of the head of a pencil. And that head of a pencil cancer is not likely to do very much damage. You could imagine situations in which it did, but 99% of the time, it was just going to stay there because it didn't have a way of getting the food, as to say the glucose and the oxygen to it, and it also didn't have a way of getting rid of the waste products of the cancer, which is mainly lactic acid or lactate.
Mm.
So that cancer isn't going to be a problem. You probably die with it, never knowing that you ever had it.
Right.
So the philosophy of cancer shifted in the late 90s towards anti-angiogenic agents, which then expanded into the field of targeted therapy. And some of these drugs are Herceptin, Erbitux, Iressa. I mean, there's a whole list of them. I would say up until a few years ago, most of the new drugs being approved by the Food and Drug Administration were in that category of targeted drugs. So you identify a certain mutation within the cancer, and you invent a drug that's going to target that mutation. And the poster child for this was a drug called Gleevec, and Gleevec was very effective in treating the so-called gastrointestinal stromal tumors, a relatively rare kind of cancer of the intestines, and as well as a few forms of leukemia. But all of those amounted to a relatively small number of cancers. The reason I believe, and many other people believe, that the reason that Gleevec was so amazingly effective was because it targeted one mutation, a single mutation, which was the swapping of genes from one chromosome to another, back and forth, that rare or relatively rare mutation gave rise to a number of different cancers. Some very brilliant fellow figured out how to make a drug that would go after cells that had that mutation. And so that kind of guided missile treatment was very effective, which is interesting and tells us that, yes, targeted therapy could be effective if you're dealing with one single mutation for which a drug exists. But what happened was that as the oncologists got into Gleevec, into other cancers, they found that there were multiple mutations. And the cancer cells were very very changeable. You block one pathway, the cancer would develop another one. In other words, there were multiple targets that had to be, and as you started to add two of these targeted agents, then the side effects became, they were more super additive than just the two of those things. So it became impossible to give cocktails of these things in the amount that would actually control those cancers. So the whole field kind of, I won't say that it collapsed, but philosophically, the idea that you could do this just with targeted agents, that collapsed in the 2000s, and people said back to you, the only thing they knew was to then use chemo and add a targeted agent in. And so that has improved the overall picture with chemo. Chemo became more effective in many cases where you added the targeted agent into the chemo, or you found different subsets of different common diseases where somebody would come up with a drug that would target the epidermal growth factor receptor, for instance, as in lung cancer. So 5% of the patients have that mutation, or around 5 to 8%. So you test everybody, which is a nice financial bonanza for the drug industry. You find let's say 5% who have the EGFR mutation, and you give them Xalkori or some other drug like that, and now they have longer responses, but they're only one out of 20 patients. See? So you find little subsets within the overall picture that you can then target with a monoclonal antibody, a guided missile that goes to that mutation. Again, it's the same idea as the Gleevec idea. So they're picking off little parts of the cancer scene and getting extended survival, but no cures, or very few cures. So that's that was the era of the targeted therapies. Then in 2011, along came Jim Allison, who did his work at University of California, San Francisco, but moved over to MD Anderson in Texas, and he developed a drug called Yervoy, and Yervoy or ipilimumab was the first approved immune checkpoint inhibitor, and this was the critical event, I think, in our lifetime in terms of the development of medical treatment for cancer, because it did two things. One is it improved the survival time of people even with stage four cancers, like especially melanoma, tremendously, added to other treatments like radiation, for instance. And it was, this was provable through phase two and phase three clinical trials. And in 2011, the FDA approved Yervoy for the treatment of melanoma. And that's made all the difference. Now we've got many of these drugs either approved or in the pipeline. And that's the first thing. The second thing is, yeah, so there's a whole, not everybody gets to invent a whole new category of drugs right. in this world, and Jim Allison did that. The second and more important thing is that it changed people's thinking. It's sometimes harder to change people's thinking than it is to change their practice. So a lot of oncologists might prescribe these drugs simply because FDA approved them and Medicare pays for them. And so therefore they use them. But what happened is slowly, and more slowly than the change of practice, was people started to think differently about cancer. So the difference is that up until that time, people thought of immune therapy primarily as in terms of stimulating the immune system, mm-hmm. and that led to a division. So the conventional oncologist said, no, it doesn't matter, it doesn't pay, because we've tried that, we've tried to stimulate the immune system, and it just doesn't work, or it doesn't work often enough or powerfully enough for us to bother with this. That was the orthodox position. And then you had the minority position, more common among complementary doctors, which is, well, you just don't know how to stimulate the immune system. If you use our methods, then you would find that you could stimulate the immune system, and that, you know, if you use mistletoe or hypothermia or whatever you want to, you know, want to mention, that you could then be able to destroy the cancer or prolong survival that way. Well, both of those positions turned out to be limited in their understanding, because what Jim Allison and the others showed was that it really, to a great degree, the problem was that the cancer itself was blocking the immune system. The cancer was activating certain mechanisms within the immune system that were, that evolution put in place in order to prevent autoimmunity. In other words, to keep, we have this powerful, powerful mechanism within us that are of our lymphocytes and killer cells that could literally kill us in a day or two if it chose to, if I could use words like chose.
Right.
But they're kept in check through kind of a feedback mechanism, and part of that feedback mechanism to prevent autoimmunity is a substance or a break on the surface that exists on the surface of the immune cell. And when that break is activated, or we pull the break, then it slows down or stops the immune system from destroying normal tissue. So what this what the cancer does is it pulls the break on the immune system. And it does that with a particular molecule that fits into that break like a lock and key system. And once it does that, then the immune system is either stopped or hampered from being able to see, to recognize, and then to kill the cancer cell. So the cancer took care of its own adversary well in advance, sometimes well in advance of us even knowing we had cancer. So what Jim Allison, following that line of reasoning, what he did was he and others came up with drugs that could be physically interposed between the cancer cell and the immune cell to prevent that emergency switch from being thrown. And by doing that, all that happened was that the immune system now had a fighting chance to kill the cancer. So what people, you know, are always amazed to find out is that the immune checkpoint drugs don't kill cancer. You could put them, the pure solution of immune checkpoint inhibitors, in a test tube with cancer cells, nothing would happen.
Right.
It's completely mediated through the immune system.
Right.
And so we're back to immunotherapy, but immunotherapy with a twist, immunotherapy with a 21st century understanding of the fact that the there are substances that are in the cancer or from the cancer that are inhibiting the activity of the immune system. So this kind of, you know, kind of negates both the complementary and the conventional understanding about the immune system.
Yeah, it does. Well, look, that's very interesting. I mean, you've given us a little whirlwind tour there of the kind of world that your guide is to help people to start to navigate. It's pretty complicated, isn't it?
It is.
And quite a large chunk of the guide is given over to explaining the main medical information sources and how you navigate these. So would you explain the importance of those sources?
Happy to. So, you know, and I had to rethink or think out loud about what my own methodology was, because over 40 plus years, I mean, I've gotten just used to just doing it. But what I realized is that aside from the tool, the side tools, like for instance, the NCI Dictionary of Cancer, which is very useful for people, PubMed, which I use 100 times a day. That's to say the repository of 28 million medical journal articles. So all of that is, these are the basic, you know, pencils and paper and whatever of your craft. But there were four sources that I have mainly relied on for my knowledge or my understanding of mostly conventional cancer treatment, and those were the PDQ system of the National Cancer Institute. PDQ standing for Physicians Data Query, and then also the DaVita cancer textbook, which conveniently enough was just revised, 2019 edition, just came out as I was doing the Morse report, and then also a very important one is the up-to-date system that I subscribe to. Both of those are paid services that you can access those in many libraries, and you also can buy like a week or a month of up to date if you're just doing research on one particular condition. So those two, I would say, and the NCCN guidelines is the fourth one, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which gives you very detailed explanations for what are the legitimate treatments and what's the strength of evidence for the different treatments for different kinds of diseases, which people find, my more inquisitive consultees find very helpful, because they're double checking against their own doctors. You know, if the doctors are saying, I want you to do this particular treatment, and this happens about once a month or so, I'll have a consultee who will tell me that they're getting a particular treatment, and I'm saying, like, well, why that treatment? Because that's not indicated for your stage. I had the other day somebody who had whose doctor had a stage 2 cancer, and the doctor wanted to give chemotherapy. But if you look in the guidelines and in the textbooks, that's not that was not an indication. Chemotherapy was only reserved for a stage 3 cancer, not a stage 2 cancer. So I'm not prescribing for them, but it gave them something to be able to go back to their doctor and say, why are you saying that I have a high risk disease? On what basis are you saying I have a high risk? That sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So the doctor, it's a way of double checking. But by far, in my assessment, the two main most important sources of medical information on cancer today are the 11th edition of the DaVita Hellman and Rosenberg, cancer principles and practice of oncology. That's the one source. And the second main source is called UpToDate.com, which hundreds of thousands of doctors around the world use. And that's a more comprehensive medical site. I don't bother too much with the non-cancer related portions of it.
Sure.
But in terms of the cancer information, they're very good. I was just this morning revising my report on a particular kind of cancer, and I could see that there were up-to-date, as the name implies, but up-to-date discussions of an important paper that appeared in November 2018. So this is only 2 months ago, and I've even seen write-ups from papers appearing in December of 2018. So within a month, they've got the information there digested, highlighted, which is also another great thing for me as a person who maintains 40 reports and has to keep them up to date for the lay person or for the patient, so I can easily identify what's new. The DaVita book will have that going forward. It's just that the DaVita book just came out a couple of weeks ago, so the 2018 information is embedded into the text. It's a little harder for me to see just what's new. But going forward, the DaVita book is updated every quarter. So is the up-to-date information. And it's well-written, both of them, very, very well-written by top experts, very reliable. And I see things happening with DaVita that I wouldn't have believed possible 20 years ago. I have a YouTube video and a blog coming out in a couple of days on yogurt and cancer. And there's a lot of the information that I have about probiotics and cancer came, and I attributed, of course, straight out of the DaVita textbook. There's a chapter on the microbiome, that they say the microbes in your gut, and cancer that I wouldn't have believed possible 20 years ago.
Well, I wish some of the oncologists in the UK were reading that stuff.
They will. They're just a little bit slower to adapt, I would say. But it's coming to a country near you.
it is impressive. It's very impressive that that's in there. I agree. But it's amazing. It is. But you do advocate a kind of a caution in the way you use these systems, and not to be too superficial in a way, in the way that you take in the data, that you actually have to dig a bit to really find out what the truth is.
Right. Because there's a general tendency within oncology, and this is something I talked about 20 odd years ago in my book, Questioning Chemotherapy, but there's a bit of a language game going on, in the sense that there are two kinds of survival in oncology, and there's also a special meaning to the word response. So patients, it's very easy to deceive patients if you wanted to, by talking about survival and not specifying what kind of survival you mean, because progression-free survival or disease-free survival, but just take the idea of progression-free survival, means that during a certain period of time, the cancer didn't get any larger, more aggressive, and that's basically what it means, progression-free, didn't progress during that time. But what that means for the overall survival is another thing. I mean, you will find people who claim, for instance, that in a colon cancer, that disease-free survival or progression-free survival is a perfectly adequate marker for overall survival. What they're saying is that it's a surrogate marker. But that's just guesswork, because we know, it's reasoned guesswork, but essentially there's nothing like looking at the overall survival of the patient to see whether the median overall survival, whether or not the treatment actually worked for people in the aggregate.
Right.
So that's the thing. Yes, there are situations in which it's important to extend, you know, the survival, I mean, the progression-free survival or the disease-free survival, of course. But does that actually correlate with actually making the patients live longer? That's the question. And so what you want to look at when you look at studies, you want to look at mainly overall survival. That's the more reliable figure. It doesn't involve any subjectivity on the part of the people doing the evaluating. The person is dead or not is usually pretty clear.
Right.
So that, and also that's the most important thing to the patient. That and quality of life are the most important considerations. I would agree with people who say, you know, that progression-free survival could mean you could live shorter and have a longer progression-free survival. It happens. So the other thing is response. What does that mean? You know, the people too commonly go into the doctor and the doctor will say, well, we have 80% success with this, treating this cancer. What is success?
All right.
Meaning we get a partial shrinkage of the measurable tumor by giving this treatment. But it's called a response, or objective response rate, ORR. Well, that response may, again, have nothing to do with how long the patients actually live. Mm. You can shrink tumors, but, you know, tumors are made up of a whole host of different kinds of cells. Some of them are ordinary cancer cells. Some of them are cancer stem cells. Some of them are tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. So if you have your immune cells are invading and infiltrating the tumor, and now you've shrunk the tumor, are you sure that you didn't shrink your own army, that you didn't bomb your own troops in order to then create a victory? We lived through that with Vietnam, you know, the body count. Just because you're killing people doesn't mean necessarily that you're killing the people who are your enemies or that you're trying to get to. It could be friendly fire. You could be bombing your own soldiers. And this is what happens with a lot of chemo, is to a certain degree, and it varies greatly among different kinds of cancer, but you can't just go by the size of the tumor, because the tumor is made up of a lot of different things, some of which is very dangerous, some of which is beneficial. So it's complicated. And the bottom line for most people is going to be the overall survival, the OS, the median overall survival. Did it increase statistically significant degree, or did it not? And when you apply that yardstick, that eliminates a lot of the claims for the effectiveness of chemotherapy, because a lot of things will touch the periphery of the disease, but they don't really get at the core question: did the patient live longer? And then, if they lived longer, what was their quality of life during that time? Because just because you lived an extra couple of months, did you live those months in a way that you and your family could say goodbye, and that you could have quality time and do all the things that you wanted to do? Or were you retching and being miserable and having, you know, really horrible side effects from the treatment? What kind of end of life is that, you know?
Right.
So these are the issues, and these can, if you dig hard enough, you can answer those questions through the kind of research that I mentioned in the guide. Mm. That's what I'm there for. So that's what I'm trying to do, is show you how you can research this yourself, because many oncologists just don't have the time to explain these things to you, even if they have the inclination to do so.
Right.
They, you know, and they're pretty much, a lot of them are burned out because of the difficulty of their own position that they're put in. I mean, especially if you're treating stage 4 cancer, imagine dealing day
horrible,
in and day out
horrible.
With people, you know, where you're losing the battle most of the time. Mm. So I have compassion for the oncologist, but I think that, you know, the patients have to be, if they want to be, or the relatives want to be, more informed. The means exist to be well informed, and that's what this guide is about. That's why I think this is the most important thing that I've written, because this will go on beyond me, you know, even if I'm not around to, I'm not planning to go anywhere, but if I were not around to do this kind of research, and then others can carry this on, and this is a guide for how I do it.
Right. Well, look, that's fantastic. I mean, thank you for that. That's really sort of tied up the thinking behind your guide beautifully, and you've shown how you can empower people in that way to actually get to the truth of treatments that may genuinely help them, you know, out of the mass of ones which may not and may just destroy their last months. So really important stuff and very empowering. So in my experience, your writing, you know, it's the most thorough, it's the most balanced, the most trustworthy I've seen anywhere, and especially when it comes to contentious areas of treatment. So I'm completely confident that this guide of yours is no exception, and I'd like to underline to the listeners that this fantastic document is available entirely free as a download. So I want to encourage everybody to get out there and take a look. Whatever you think about conventional medicine, take a look, you know. I really appreciate you coming on the show today to tell us all about it, Ralph.
You're quite welcome, Robin. It's great talking to you. And, you know, I really appreciated you inviting me to your conference a few years ago. Mm. It was momentous, really momentous. And I feel for the people of the UK, because I don't know exactly what the mixture is there, but it just seems as if complementary medicine just has an awfully hard time getting itself established in your country. And I don't know enough about the history of this to understand exactly why this is so, but you have a very hardcore group, I would say, that's in the ascendancy in terms of oncology and are very intolerant of new ideas and of different new ways of doing things. I saw this in 1980 when I went over to, I think it was Wembley, there was a big conference center there, and I talked about this in my blog yesterday a little bit, because Linus Pauling was also invited to that, and I did a blog on vitamin C, on the latest findings coming out of University of Iowa on the benefit of intravenous vitamin C. Mm-hmm. But I saw the way Pauling was treated, even though he was a two-time Nobel laureate, the lack of respect and the lack of sympathy for the point of view that there could be other ways other than what the establishment recommended. And sometimes I get the feeling, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I get the feeling with British oncologists that they're sort of trying to prove to the Americans that they are, you know, even more gung-ho than the American oncologists are in pushing these conventional treatments. I don't know if that's the truth or not, but it's just a feeling.
You could be right. Certainly in years gone by, Britain always looked to America as doing, you know, higher dose chemotherapy or more sophisticated technology. Yeah. It was always, we're trying to keep up with the best American centers. You don't hear that anymore, funnily enough. I hadn't heard so much. Well, it's good and it's not good. I think it's because integrative medicine has taken some hold in America and they're just not interested here. But on the positive side, I will say, since you came over and spoke for us, it's a short 3 years, but an awful lot has happened in terms of the goalposts moving. Simply because the crisis of our health service financially has driven the government to look for different solutions to the problems they have. Mm-hmm. And there's some extraordinary things just beginning to happen. It's just really now that we're breaking through with very new approaches to chronic disease. So I'm very optimistic about the next 5-10 years.
Good. Mm. Good. Well, you know, what amazed me, the last two YouTube videos that I've done, which are also coincided with my blogs. Mm-hmm. So one of them was on vitamin C being proven at the University of Iowa to have a substantial effect of survival in advanced stage pancreatic cancer. Oh, so the patients got this a standard treatment for pancreatic cancer, and then they added in intravenous vitamin C, and they got about a 9 or 10 month extension of survival, which was almost a doubling of the survival time. And that all they did was give this so-called IVC.
Yeah.
So that was amazing. That was a complete reversal of judgment on the old Pauling-Mortel battle that went on in the 1980s over vitamin C, where it turned out that the Mayo Clinic, Charles Mortel and company at the Mayo Clinic, had failed to give the patients vitamin C intravenously. They only gave it orally, which is about 1/100th effectiveness of giving it intravenously. Mm-hmm. So no surprise, the patients didn't seem to have much of an effect from the vitamin C. And then they declared victory over vitamin C.
Yeah.
Not exactly V for victory.
No.
And then that almost killed the field for many years.
Mm.
But here was the amazing bit. The amazing bit was that the National Cancer Institute in the U.S. has given $5.5 million to the University of Iowa to continue these studies and to do more rigorous trials. So that was the first thing that hit me.
Fantastic.
A week later, I'm doing an article about probiotics and yogurt and the effect of the gut microbiome on people's response to immune checkpoint inhibitors, the kind of immune drugs we were just talking about. Is a very profound relationship between the healthiness of your gut, namely the particular microbes that are found there, and your odds of responding well to immunotherapy. And I hope that your listeners will take a look at my my YouTube and my blog.
I'll post on
that, which is at Moss Report. You can access that through mossreports.com. But here was the thing that struck me. So I'm reading, there's a whole chapter on microbiome and cancer, way right up at the front of the DaVita textbook.
Mm.
And I see an Italian name as the author of this chapter, and I go and I look at the author attributions, and he's a department head at the National Cancer Institute in the U.S.
Hmm.
The whole division is like 20 people working on this.
Fantastic.
And there's work being done at the University of Chicago, and some of this is human clinical work, not just laboratory work.
Right.
But it's so you have the fact that in the DaVita textbook, which is the most orthodox pro-chemo book in previous iterations of that book.
Yeah.
And now, right up at the front, you have a whole big, very positively toned chapter on the relationship of the gut and the health of the bacteria in the gut to cancer, which I consider to be very close to alternative medicine.
Very.
In the sense that, this is a thing that only the so-called health food nuts cared about up until a few years ago.
That's right.
Now it's established. You're seeing this more and more. You're seeing the ideas of alternative medicine infiltrating into the mainstream.
Yeah.
People who didn't put their careers on the line exactly to do this, but quietly were moving things forward a little at a time, and now you've got it's starting to look like a different thing altogether, because whether it's attributed to the pioneers or not, but it still has altered the thinking of the young oncologists who don't find anything particularly surprising about this. Or, I mean, when you talk about the gut microbiome, you're talking about your diet, you're talking about yogurt, you're talking about taking probiotics and particular kinds of probiotics. All of this was the province of the naturopath. And now, lo and behold, your conventional docs have discovered this as well. So I think this is very encouraging. And the fact that 2 weeks in a row, NCI, which I always considered the quote-unquote the enemy because of their opposition to, during the Laetrol days and the days of other non-conventional treatments, they always acted like the enemy of alternative ideas. But obviously, two generations have passed since then, and some good stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And we have to give the devil his due. If they are the devil, we have to give them their due because they're doing the right thing, and that's tremendous. We don't want to fight. We want to work together.
Collaborate.
And get everybody being open to to the new ideas, especially things that are minimally toxic, if toxic at all. You think about the miracle of vitamin C.
Yes.
How much is given? This is what always amazes me. I've had it myself, intravenous vitamin C. But they're putting like ounces of this stuff into your bloodstream, and
yep.
you just feel good. You
yep.
don't.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, I'm sure there are people who acted against it, but by and large, people don't feel bad. And yet, if you give an inconceivably small dose of some of this chemo, you feel like hell. Mm-hmm. You know. So mm-hmm. the people love vitamin C. They love the idea of it. They love the idea of the intravenous vitamin C. And it turns out, it does work
yeah.
to a certain yeah. degree. And by the way, I have a kind of red, amber, and green light system for quickly ranking the alternative type treatments. And even though I'm emotionally very attached to vitamin C, I haven't ever had vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C, in the green light category. And to celebrate these University of Iowa studies, I moved vitamin C for the 2019. More
right.
supports into the green category,
well,
which
momentous.
Brings me more in line with most alternative doctors. But hey, you know, I mean, it's not that I didn't know. I knew too much in a way because, you know, I could only go by what the data shows. I'm not going to, just because my heart tells me that I want vitamin C to be proven effective in honor of Dr. Pauling and Dr. Albert St. George in particular. That's not enough of a reason for me to say, yes, that I'm going to give a green light on that. But now I feel with this very well done University of Iowa study and the new NCI supported studies about to be launched, I think it's a fair guess that, yes, you will get benefit from doing that. And as I say, it's compared to almost everything and anything else you could think of, it's remarkably non-toxic, even in large doses. So, you know, that's exciting that it's now gotten sort of the green light, and we're going to see a lot of development now, I think, coming about.
Amazing. Well, thanks for the good news. That's very upbeat. All right. Well, look, this is stuff we could talk about forever. I'm going to have to wrap it up. It's been really interesting, Ralph. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, Robin, great as always talking to you, and I hope we'll meet again sometime soon.
So do I. Thank you.
Okay, bye. Bye-bye.
You can hear the astonishment and enthusiasm in Ralph's response to recent developments after decades in the trenches up against dogmatic establishment views. As usual, you can find links to materials mentioned by Ralph on the Yes to Life website, and that's yestolife.org.uk. Click the show logo that's on the homepage. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm so pleased to be able to bring you brilliant and pioneering guests such as Ralph Moss. Please make a point of joining me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.